It is Friday, July 26, 2013. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Callums.
And I'm Yitzhak Krahita. Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. Support for KUAF comes from the Fayetteville Underground, promoting the visual arts in Northwest Arkansas, supporting artists working to the highest standards, and contributing to the advancement of Fayetteville as a destination city for the arts. Information regarding art shows, concerts, and more available at FayettevilleUnderground.com.
On this edition of Ozarks, take three musicians who all live in different cities and have never played together before, put them in a room for a day, and then cut that first rehearsal short because one of the musicians' parked car is hit. Then they play that first gig the next day. That's what happened as the trio pianos and drums came to the Furman Garner Performance Studio. We'll hear how their improbable story turned into a band.
Plus, one of the state's most popular news blogs is going behind a paywall. Kyle talks to Alan Leverett, the publisher of the Arkansas Times, about the changing face of digital journalism.
First, Arkansas lawmakers heard concerns yesterday afternoon from the heads of several community health clinics who say one aspect of the private option will mean they won't be able to be reimbursed well enough to stay open. The Public Health Committee met for an update on the plan to expand health care coverage in the state. Kathy Grisham is executive director of Community Clinic in Northwest Arkansas. She says one waiver currently allowed under the plan would cost her a lot of money.
I ran the numbers looking at my audited figures from 2012. And under the private option that's proposed, we would be losing between $500,000 and $1.5 million.
Lawmakers expressed concern about talk that a lawsuit could be filed, which would have an impact on implementation of the private option. However, John Selig, director of the Department of Human Services, says he's confident a change can be implemented.
These community health centers, obviously, they serve as a safety net, particularly in the rural areas. And they have additional costs, additional requirements from the federal government. And they're concerned that if all they get is a payment from insurance companies that's comparable to what they normally pay, that won't be enough to cover their costs.
Selig says the state's private option proposal will be submitted for approval on August 2nd, with officials hoping for federal approval by October.
State lawmakers are looking for ways to administer the death penalty after Attorney General Dustin McDaniel cast doubt on the state's ability to carry out the sentence. McDaniel told a joint judiciary committee hearing earlier this week that a combination of litigation, unavailability of the lethal drug, and a shortage of medical personnel willing to carry out an execution led him to believe the system is broken. At the center of the issue is the shortage of lethal doses. There are no domestic manufacturers of the drug, and the FDA has restricted its import. Senator Jeremy Hutchinson of Benton asked if domestic sources could be found.
It's simply a matter of supply, that there's nothing that can be done. Are there any states that have an overabundance of supplies or a supply that they ended the capital punishment and have a leftover supply that would not have to be transported or brought in from a foreign country?
Ray Hobbs, the director of the Department of Correction, answered Hutchinson's question.
Senator, they do. They're not sharing it with us. okay. And most of it is expired like ours had expired. So there is a time limit for them.
The state has the option of using its previous method, the electric chair, or weighing the litigation risks of implementing firing squads or the gas chamber. McDaniel says he believed those options would come with equal, if not more, baggage than lethal injection.
Though Ozark Regional Transit has been managed by a contracted company for the Transit Authority's modern history, that stands to change after this year. Last night, the ORT Board of Directors voted to take management of the two-county transit provider in-house. Jerry Van Hoos, chair of the ORT board, says First Transit has managed the transit system effectively through a period of growth.
And they've been a lot of help to us and helped us grow the system, because when we started, we really didn't have any management expertise. So that's been for about 10 years. Well, the way the federal law is, after a certain period of time, because we do have federal dollars in our operations, we would be required to open the solicitation up to include other management firms and make a selection.
So Van Hoos says the board felt, with First Transit's contract expiring at the end of the year, now is an opportune time to take over managing the day-to-day operations of the transit system.
And we could save some money, even though we feel our money was really well spent with this other firm. They've done us a really good job. But we felt like we could move forward with the management team we have in place, and hopefully we can hire that person. And so we'll have about $150,000, $200,000 a year that we can put in providing more rides for our clients.
The resolution passed last night included a provision to ask current ORT Executive Director Joel Gardner, who First Transit moved to Northwest Arkansas late last year, to remain with the Transit Authority after the contract with First Transit expires.
Earlier this week, the Arkansas Highway Transportation Department announced its schedule of the first 30 state road projects to be contracted using proceeds from the new half-cent state sales tax. The first six projects are all in Northwest Arkansas. Danny Straisley with the Arkansas Highway Department says three of those projects are portions of the Vela Vista Bypass, while the other three are improvements to Interstate 540. Straisley says the schedule for the projects was less about priority or precedence and more about which projects are already prepped for construction.
A lot of these projects have existed for years as studies. Some of them have just been sitting on the shelf just waiting for funding, which is pretty much what the Bella Vista bypass has seen. There are other projects that are further along in the design process. The surveys have been completed. The design is more than 50% complete, and they can bring those projects to contract a lot sooner than some of the other projects.
Also, during the meeting in which the projects were announced, the Highway Commission awarded a contract for expanding Interstate 540 to three lanes between Weddington Drive and Porter Road in Fayetteville.
The Advancement Division at the University of Arkansas finished the fiscal year with a balanced budget. Yesterday, the university announced when the books on the 2013 fiscal year are closed at the end of this month. The division will end the year with $13.4 million in expenditures. The balanced budget is reportedly a result from cutbacks in every department, including leaving vacant positions unfilled. In addition, $13.3 million has been approved for the division's 2014 fiscal year budget. Officials anticipate closing the books on the 2013 fiscal year with a $30 million surplus and a liquidity of $160 million, the highest in the history of the university.
After winning three games against the Arkansas Travelers in Springdale, the first place Northwest Arkansas Naturals last night started a seven-game stretch on the road. The Nats won the first of four against the Springfield Cardinals 6-0. Play continues tonight in Springfield.
Cloudy tonight, slight chance of showers and a low in the lower 60s in Northwest Arkansas. 50% chance of rain and lows in the mid-60s for the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow, mostly sunny, highs from the lower 80s in Northwest Arkansas to around 88 for the River Valley. And for Saturday night, partly cloudy, lows from 58 to 65. It is the final Friday of July. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me on the phone is Michael Tilley, who is the editor and publisher of the City Wire that covers business, politics, culture, and more. Are you prepared for the end of July, Michael Tilley?
Well, you know, every time it seems like these are becoming more frequent where you say it's the final Friday or it's the final something, and it's like, man, that's just going by too fast.
I just want us all to be aware of our mortality.
Well, you're doing a great job at that.
Well, fantastic. Let's talk about some tax revenue figures. Stop me if I sound like a broken record. Fort Smith tax revenues down, Northwest Arkansas up.
Yes, well, I should have stopped you because that is sounding like a broken record. But it's unfortunately for the Fort Smith area, it's very true. Again, their sales tax revenue in their June report, I was down more than 4% compared to their budget expectations. It's 3 months in a row that the collections are down, and you know they've already implemented one budget cut of about a 4% across the board cut in all departments. And you know it'll be interesting to see if this continues. One of the more interesting things with the numbers is the level of decline in the countywide collections, what the city receives from the countywide collections, and that's so critical because that funds the city's general operations, which includes you know, emergency services, fire and police, so that certainly bears watching. But in Northwest Arkansas, it's continues to be gangbusters. I mean, they're just rolling double-digit increases for Rogers and Bentonville. Fayetteville and Springdale are up also. But just, you know, when you have that economy, it's a function, as we say here, it's a function of jobs. And the job market in Northwest Arkansas is growing, and it's not growing in Fort Smith.
Well, this translates over to something that you posted on thecitywire.com early last evening, which is that the CityWire home sales report is just out. Sales in Arkansas's, most of Arkansas's major markets up. In Fort Smith, a decline.
Right, and you know, we look at the Arkansas the home sales report. We look at the four largest metro areas in the state. And just so your readers know, we look at 14 counties out of 75. That may not seem like a lot, but those counties account for between 70 and 75% of total Arkansas home sales. So we use that. It's a good index, and it's been well received. But yes, the central Arkansas area, northwest Arkansas area, and Jonesboro, those three metro areas were up. And again, Fort Smith was down. And it all goes back to the jobs market. Now I'm sounding like the broken record, but you know, the employment rate and unemployment rate in Fort Smith area has been at or above 7% for, I think, going on 53 or 54 consecutive months now. And that's just not, we're not seeing that in those other metro areas. But the good news for Arkansas is that for the first 6 months of 2013, home sales were up almost 9% in central Arkansas, up almost 11% in Jonesboro, up a little over 14% in northwest Arkansas. Now, in the Fort Smith area, like we said, they were down about 2.5%. But overall, for Arkansas, it's the residential market is back.
Now, of all the reports that you create at thecitywire.com, my favorite named one is the Bologna Sandwich Index. And this week, the Bologna Sandwich Index suggests that the jobless rate in Fort Smith should dip in June.
Well, and let's hope it's correct. And the credit for this must go to Ken Kupchick. He is Director of Marketing and Development for the River Valley Regional Food Bank. And several years ago, I think it was 2009 or 2010, he works with St. John's sack lunch program and providing food. And he thought there might be a correlation between the number of bologna sandwiches they serve in their sack lunch program and the trend of the jobless rate. Well, so he's a financial guy, number cruncher, so he put the pen to paper, and sure enough, there's roughly about anywhere from a 65% to 70% correlation between the number of bologna sandwiches they serve in 1 month and what the unemployment rate will be in the next month. So based on his numbers, the jobless rate, which was 7.7% in May in the Fort Smith area, should dip. So that'll be welcome news.
Well, if there is a theme to our conversation this morning, it is about jobs. There is hope that there will be more jobs in the Fort Smith metro area, because we hear that what's going on at Chaffee Crossing, which has been development and new business, is continuing.
Well, and let's hope so. I mean, if there's a bright spot, I should say, you know, Chaffee Crossing is certainly one of them. Of course, we can't forget that Phoenix Village area, which is, mm-hmm. I mean, there'll be over 1,000 jobs in just that little 35-acre spot of town. But that and Chaffee Crossing, they've had a lot of positive announcements in the last 6 months in the Fort Smith area. I mean, there are reasons. I know may sound like we're down on Fort Smith. I mean, but the numbers are what the numbers are. But there have been good jobs announcement. You've got the I-49 segment being built through Chaffee Crossing. You know, Umarex and Walter out at Chaffee Crossing have said they're going to expand. There's a 500-unit apartment complex that's going to be going up out there. Talk of the 70-store shopping center, although I still have some doubts. I'm just not sure the market can support another large shopping center, but that remains to be seen. But the point, though, Kyle, make to your listeners is that the Fort Smith area has had a sustained job loss for many years, and it's going to take more than just a few announcements to get the area employment levels back up to where they need to be, or even back to where they were in 2007 and 2006. So these are good positive announcements, and let's just keep our fingers crossed that it continues.
Finally, the aquatics park that we've talked about before has taken another small step toward reality.
Well, I don't know if small step. I mean, I would like to think, and maybe as a journalist that watches this, I should kind of know where we are in this process. But this thing is so dorked up. I mean, yes, they're interviewing. They have 13 construction companies interviewing for the construction management process. But here's the issue, Kyle. We don't yet know. We're still waiting on a attorney general opinion as to if that form of project development is legal under the Arkansas law. So. And that opinion is pending. It could come any day. Heck, it could be in my email box now. But So they're, the city and the county are interviewing folks to build this $8 million or whatever it's going to be water park, but if the AG's opinion comes back and says you can't do it this way, that's all for naught. So then who knows if it's a step forward.
If the AG's opinion comes back saying that you can't do it this way, does it go all the way back then to the bidding process? Or the,
well,
I mean,
yeah, yes. It, I mean, they'll have to figure out several things, and the primary thing will, okay, what's our cost now going to be? What can we afford? And there may also be some repercussions that go back more than just this water park deal.
That's
because
right.
that form of construction has been used by the county on some other projects. So I don't know what – I don't know if county be held harmless on that or what the repercussions will be. But as they used to say, stay tuned.
Finally, we've both referenced broken records in this conversation. When was the last time you actually heard a broken record?
I don't know, but I do have a CD that skips, and
okay.
When I loaded it into iTunes, the skip is still there. So, and I just—that's funny you ask. I was thinking recently, I've got to get that fixed.
Okay, well, happy to help, Michael.
Yeah.
Michael Tilley is the editor and publisher of thecitywire.com. We talk to him almost every Friday. Thank you, Michael.
Well, you're welcome. I'm going to go work on my cassette deck, too.
Okay, very good.
What drives someone to hike to the North Pole or row across the ocean alone?
I was doing something, you know. I was out there on the edge, stepping into ground where nobody had ever been before, you know, exploring.
I'm Guy Raz. On the next TED Radio Hour, we're taking you to the edge.
To the edge, that sounds tailored for me.
From NPR.
The TED Radio Hour, Sunday at noon on KUAF 91.3 FM.
It is Friday, July 26, 2013. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Callums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
With us, Becca Martin-Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
I can't decide whether to just tell the truth or not.
Which would be more exciting for this segment?
Well, even if you don't like The King and I, I would strongly suggest that you go to the Rogers Little Theater production.
Okay.
Because the guy playing the king is gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
The woman playing Anna Leon Owens is gorgeous and has a beautiful voice and is like a Disney princess on stage. How could you not have a good time?
It's going to open tonight.
It does. You know, it's interesting. Ed McClure, who's directing it, said he worried about how do you make this show relevant? Because it's set in the 1860s. It premiered on Broadway in the 1950s. How do you make it relevant? And he said he figured out that it's really about two people and two cultures that don't trust each other or getting to know each other. And once they figure it out, it's all good. And maybe we should all try that and then dance with each other.
Very relevant. Dancing solves everything.
Very relevant. So, interestingly, the actress playing Anna Leon Owens is a veteran actress, has lived in New York, done touring productions, done off-Broadway productions. Her name is Sarah Anders. She was brought to Northwest Arkansas by her husband. Thank him very much. Also interesting, Matthew Makeda, who is playing the king, didn't do any drama in high school, went to college, and is majoring in drama, but mostly film. And when he appeared in Chicago last summer for Rogers Little Theater, it was his first play.
Oh, wow.
He's worked a year for this role because he knew the show was coming up, and Ed McClure told him, you're really going to have to work for it. And he has. He walks onto the stage, and he owns it just like he should, and it's a wonderful production. 8 o'clock today and tomorrow, 2 o'clock Sunday, two more weekends after that. $16 for balcony seating, $45 with dinner. Also this weekend, tonight is Music on the Square in Kingston. If you have no idea where that is, you should find out and go there. It's a lot of fun. Pat Hall and John Stiers are performing tonight at 7 o'clock.
Is that every week or just?
It's once a month.
Once a month, right. Okay, could not remember.
Annie Jr. is tonight, presented by Trike Theater.
Mm-hmm.
7 o'clock today, 2 o'clock tomorrow at Arendt Art Center in Bentonville. Tickets are $8 to $12 at the door. Shenandoah is performing tonight at Cherokee, or rather tomorrow night at Cherokee Casino in West Siloam Springs. Popular in the late 1980s. Too bad I didn't practice talking before I came here. They had hits like Next to You, Next to Me, and Sunday in the South. Showtime is 10:30. And the opening band is called the Beer and Chicken Band.
Okay.
At 7 o'clock. Little Southern Gospel and Bluegrass, 7 o'clock tomorrow night at the King Opera House in Van Buren with the representatives. quartet, which usually has six members in it.
So it's a quartet plus.
Yes, it's a quartet plus
two. Quartet with guests.
Yes.
If you've never been to the King Opera House, I finally got to go there a couple of weeks ago. What a beautiful facility.
It's on my list.
It is gorgeous. Great acoustics, nice people, fun performances. $10 for a good time on Saturday night. Or a little bit more, $20 for a good time on Saturday night. The second installment of the KUAF Summer Jazz Concert Series.
Composer Showcase.
What do you know about him?
Rix Allen, he's been writing music seriously for about 9 years. You're going to hear a lot of his original compositions by all sorts of different ensembles and The Rite of Spring as adapted for an 18-piece big band.
Really?
Yes. Robert Ginsberg, the host of Shades of Jazz, sat in on one of the rehearsals this week and he said, it's something else.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That's worth $20. Showtime is 8 o'clock in the Star Theater at Walton Arts Center, and you can get tickets at 443-5600.
All right.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
This is Ozarks at Large. The Arkansas Times has been a staple in this state for nearly 40 years. It began with a few hundred dollars and not much more. In the 39 years since, it has been a glossy monthly, then a free newsprint weekly, then a free newsprint weekly with a substantial web presence. The Arkansas Times blog was one of the first, if not the first, influential web presences in the state, and it's still one of the most read. Visitors to the blog Thursday morning saw and heard a video announcing a digital paywall platform for the blog content.
The publishing landscape is changing, and so if we're going to keep doing the kind of reporting that we become known for, if this voice, a somewhat progressive voice, is going to continue in a fairly conservative state, we're going to have our readers step up and help us.
With me on the phone is Alan Leverett. He's the publisher of the Arkansas Times, and welcome to Ozarks at Large.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
The decision to have a paywall function, because it's not a simple paywall. There are levels.
It's metered.
Yes, it's metered. How long had this been in discussion?
Well, we've been working on this for about 4 months, and recently, Max Bradley, who is the originator of the Arkansas blog on the Arkansas Times website, he was also editor of the Times, and we had paid his salary out of the print edition of the Arkansas Times. Well, Max now is, quote, retired, unquote, and now he devotes 60 hours a week strictly to the website and the blog. And, you know, the Arkansas Times is an independent, indigenous voice here in Arkansas. We generally take progressive stands, a bit left of center, and it's an important voice. I mean, you know, I believe in a free market of ideas. I think you need a lot of different ideas out there on the street for people, for the public to be able to cipher through and see which way they believe. And frankly, for us to continue doing journalism at the level that we're doing it, we've got to have reader participation. We've got to have reader support. We can't do it just with advertising, because web advertising, while we sell a lot of web advertisement, it just doesn't bring in the money the print does. And now Max, our blog editor, is full-time on the blog, and the only way that we can continue having him at the level that we have is if we have the reader step up and bear part of the burden. But it's worth it, I think.
You mentioned Max is doing 60 hours a week. The other staff members who write for the weekly are also spending time on
Absolutely.
The web.
Absolutely. And we've just seen, you know, we've seen the page views grow to over 1.5 million a month. We average between 210 to 250,000 unique visitors every month. The blog is what drives the traffic at the Arkansas Times website, because it's breaking news. Max, you know, Max used to be one of the editors at the old Arkansas Gazette, and so he covered politics for years, and so he knows where everybody is buried out of the state legislature. And you don't have someone with that kind of institutional memory very often. And he knows, and he'll sit there at his desk. I'll walk in the morning, he looks like some bond daddy sitting up there, you know, the phone's just ringing away, and he's got a phone in one ear, he's got a cell phone in the other. And it's, you know, he has all of these contacts, and so it makes for very, very rich journalism. And, I mean, he's been at this for 40-some-odd years. And so We think it's quality journalism. It's a unique voice. He does 20 posts a day on everything from politics to business to breaking news to linking to commentary in national and international publications about their writing about Arkansas. And so to have this kind of resource is really, really valuable to the state. But, you know, we can't do it by ourselves. And we need, we're asking for our readers, if you value this sort of journalism, this sort of independent journalism in an age of corporate chain journalism, if you value this independent journalism, then we're asking for your help.
Wow, you could have just done a public radio plea right there.
Well, so see, you know, that's interesting. You said paywall. We don't even use the word paywall. We use the phrase a digital membership in the Arkansas Times, and it's on the NPR model.
Mm.
You know, it's journalism worth paying for. And so, and I want to stress this, this is a metered paywall, as you say. So you can come like 10 times a month, or if someone's, you know, if you're doing a search on Google for a certain thing, I mean, it'll pop up. But if you're the type of person that, you know, goes there several times a day to check in to see what else is happening, then, you know, that's the person that we hope will step up and pay $10 a month and $9.99 a month to have access to that and also to support that, just as you do your NPR station.
I'm wondering when you realized that suddenly, or not suddenly, but at some point you were doing two different things. You were a daily journalism outlet.
Oh, we knew that. We knew that very early on. And, you know, of course, Max comes from a daily newspaper background, and so do I. So, you know, when we were doing a weekly, well, fair enough, and it was always so frustrating because Max would have to hold stories until, you know, the next publishing cycle, you know, the next week. And now we don't hold those stories. When we got them, they go onto the website. The rest of the content of the website is still free.
So what's in the weekly paper?
What's in the weekly paper, which is free, continues to be free online. But what we're doing every day here in terms of updating and this constant breaking news that we're doing on a daily basis and often on an hourly basis, that's what we need the support on. That's what we need the help on.
You are the first weekly to do this with the blog?
Yeah, we're the first alternative weekly in the country to do this. But you got to realize boy, we have some great, great alternative weeklies around the country. In Tulsa, we've got them in Dallas and in Atlanta. Little Rock is actually one of the smallest, or Arkansas is one of the smallest markets in the country that has an alternative weekly. But most alternative weeklies don't have something like the Arkansas blog.
Right.
And that's you got to have that. If I was doing a normal alt weekly, I would never ask people, because most of what they do, they just put what's on their newspaper. They put that on the line. So that's not of any real extra value. Well, but this is different.
Do you think that in 15 or 20 years' time, people will look back and say, wow, Arkansas was kind of ahead of the curve on how to do this? Because Walter Hussman with the Democrat Gazette?
Yeah, no, Walter's done a great job with it, and Walter's kind of been the inspiration for the whole industry and has done a great job. However, you know, there's a difference. The Democrat is doing a paywall to protect their print subscriptions. In other words, they don't want people canceling their subscription and going online. We're not trying to protect anything. I mean, the newspaper is out there, the weekly, the Arkansas Times weekly newspaper is out there. And frankly, I mean, we do 25,000 copies a week. I could do 40,000 copies a week if I could afford to print that many papers and charge my advertisers that much extra money. But what we're trying to do is raise money, because we cannot do this kind of journalism in this economic environment, in this political environment, without the support of the readers. The readers, if they want this voice, and it's a unique voice here in Arkansas, if you want that voice to continue, then you need to support it.
Alan Leverett is the publisher of the Arkansas Times. Alan, thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you for having me.
Fayetteville's first Thursday outdoor art walk season returns August 1st. That's next Thursday, starting at 5 o'clock on the downtown square. Students from the Fayetteville Music Factory will perform on the main stage from 5 to 5:30, followed by Trout Fishing in America as part of the Fayetteville Public Library's Kid Stage from 5:45 to 6:30. And Joe Giles and the Homewreckers will close out the evening from 7 until 9. The Walton Arts Center will host special Broadway trivia and appearances from Walton Arts Center Broadway characters throughout the night.
Two interesting musical performances, both free, presented soon by Opera in the Ozarks. Saturday night at 8, we'll feature the Vocal Music Camp at Opera in the Ozarks theater presentation of Dr. Seuss's Broadway musical, Seussical. And Tuesday night at 7, Opera in the Ozarks will present the, I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly, the Altius String Quartet? I don't know. That will take place in The Odd in downtown Eureka Springs. The quartet will be artists in residence for Opera in the Ozarks String and Piano Camp. The concert will celebrate the 20th year of the String and Piano Camp for outstanding junior and senior high music students.
The Fayetteville Public Library will present the Northwest Arkansas premiere of Ain't In It For My Health, a documentary about musician and Arkansas native Levon Helm, at 6:45 p.m. Friday, August 9th, followed by a panel discussion featuring those who knew him. Director Jacob Hatley spent 2.5 years with the former singer and drummer for the band at his Woodstock, New York home, where Helm was creating his first studio album in 25 years, the Grammy Award-winning Dirt Farmer.
Perhaps the most famous Arkansan to not live in the White House is Johnny Cash. The Man in Black is the only songwriter or musician to be inducted to the Country Music Hall of Fame, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, the Songwriters Hall of Fame, and the Gospel Music Hall of Fame. Before he was enshrined in any of those houses, he was growing up in a small house in rural Arkansas. For the past few years, there have been efforts to make that boyhood home into a museum. As Jonathan Reeves from our content partner KASU reports, that work is nearing completion.
As the third annual Johnny Cash Music Festival nears, restoration work on the boyhood home of Johnny Cash nears completion. Dr. Ruth Hawkins of Arkansas State University says the goal is to let visitors see what life was like for the seven Cash siblings and their parents in the 1940s and early 1950s. She gives an update on the project.
We've basically completed the restoration of the home in terms of the actual interior and exterior restoration. We're working now on the furnishings for the interior as well as the landscaping and other finishing touches. And so we're hoping that the proceeds from this next concert will enable us to finish that project, or at least the first phase of it.
Hawkins tells how the Cash family has been involved in the process.
All of the Cash family members have been extremely supportive. Joanne and Tommy obviously grew up in the house, and so they remember what was in the house. They remember all of the furnishings. They have described them to us, and we are now in the process of going out and finding the things that they have described. In fact, they've even made a couple of trips with us to look for things, and they've sent us things as they've found things. So they're looking. We also have people that are helping us look. We have an opportunity for people to get involved with this. We've created an online registry. It can be found at johnnycashmusicfest.com. But you can go and look at this registry, and it lists all of the things that we need for the house and what we've already acquired. And we're hoping that people will say, oh, I've got one of those, or, oh, I know where I can get that, or, oh, I saw that online. I'll buy that and donate it to the project. So a lot of people are doing that. And everybody that donates to the project will have their name on a plaque as being a part of furnishing the Johnny Cash boyhood home. So they've been very helpful in helping us to furnish the house.
Dr. Hawkins tells about additional work that is being done.
We are also working on the restoration of the administration building as well as the exhibits that will go in that building. Basically, there'll be exhibits that focus on what the Dice Colony was all about. It was an agricultural resettlement community during the New Deal. So there'll be exhibits focused on that. There'll be exhibits that talk about the lifestyle of those colonists, including the Cash family. And then there'll be a room that talks specifically about Johnny Cash and the Cash family and how growing up in Dice actually impacted Johnny Cash and his music.
And she tells about the different exhibits that will be part of the project.
A lot of his music is directly impacted, such songs as 5 Feet High and Rising, which is based on the 1937 flood. Songs like Pickin' Time are certainly right out of his experiences in the field. So those projects, the administration building and the house, will open in April. But then we have other phases that we are working on. We will be working on all of the outbuildings for the Cash home, putting back the barn, the outhouse, the smokehouse, the corn crib, chicken coop, those kinds of things. We'll be rebuilding the theater building, which is next door to the administration building. Once that theater building is complete, that will be an orientation center for the whole project, and there'll be an orientation video that talks about the project. So that'll be where people will go to buy their tickets and get an orientation. They'll go through the exhibits at the administration building. They will be shuttled out to the boyhood home after getting the orientation at the administration building. And eventually, one phase is to build a walking and biking trail that will connect the Dice Colony Center with the Johnny Cash Boyhood Home.
Dr. Hawkins estimates about 50,000 people annually could come see the home, which could bring about $10 million annually to the region. That figure accounts for hotel stays, visits to restaurants, gas stations, and more. But she says there's another feature or another area that will be a focus.
For us here at Arkansas State University, of course, we're interested in the economic benefits that it will have for the region, but we're also interested in the educational benefits, because along with tourism, we will be having seminars and workshops and all sorts of programming that will focus on looking at his music and analyzing that music and how it was impacted by the region. We'll look at the New Deal era and analyze a lot of, you know, how successful was that? Where did it fail? A lot of opportunities for research and educational programming. Even already, all of the research that has been done for this project to date has been done by graduate students in our Heritage Studies PhD program. So it's already had a major impact just on, you know, being able to get hands-on experience and do the research associated with the project.
And the third annual Johnny Cash Music Festival takes place Saturday, August 17th at the Convocation Center in Jonesboro. This year's concert features Vince Gill, Joanne Cash Yates, Tommy Cash, Larry Gatlin and the Gatlin Brothers, and Jimmy Fortune of the Statler Brothers. Tickets for the event are on sale now, and proceeds from the concert will benefit the Restoration Project, and additional funds will go to college scholarships. Both the Johnny Cash House and the Administration Building are expected to open sometime in April.
Jonathan Reeves from our content partner KASU filed that story for Ozarks at Large from Jonesboro.
Next time on Ask Me Another, we get some parental tips from actor, comedian, and long-suffering father of two, Michael Ian Black.
When they say they hate you, it's best to just go, I hate me too.
Join Michael and me, Ophira Eisenberg, for an hour of puzzles, word games, and trivia. Game on!
Ask Me Another, tomorrow morning at 11 on KUAF.
On Ozarks at Large, you often hear us talking to bands who have been together for years. But there are also musicians in the area who get together only temporarily for a couple of performances. One such group, Pianos and Drums. The trio was created by Fayetteville-based drummer Nate Wong, who recruited his friends Jonah Wehas, who's based in Chicago, and Yaniv Tobenhaus, who's based in New York City. Recently, the trio stopped by the Furman Garner Performance Studio to speak with Of Note host Katie Hendrickson. All three musicians had gathered as a group for the first time just the day before the interview. During their conversation with Katie, the musicians explained how Pianos and Drums came to be.
My name is Nate Wong, and I am the drummer of this band. I'm also kind of the guy that came up with it. Jonah's a good friend of mine from Berkeley, and Yanif is a good friend of mine from here in Fayetteville. And they didn't meet until yesterday, and I got this band together. And just kind of a project band. We're just doing a couple gigs here in Fayetteville, a couple gigs in Tulsa. And, yeah, it's just getting good musicians together to make music.
Yeah, my name is Jonah Wehas. I'm currently based out of Chicago, Illinois. Nate and I go back to, we met at school at Berklee College of Music, and there we started kind of writing really goofy tunes on the piano together. We would come over late at night and just jam out on the piano, four hands, yes. One piano.
And everything came out goofy.
Everything, that was the theme, goofy, right? Goofy, but, you know. and so, yeah, he called me and pitched this idea, and I loved it. And so, yeah, like he said, I met Yaniv yesterday, and we just started playing and having a lot of fun.
My name is Yaniv Talbanaz. I lived here for 2.5 years. I was going to school here at the University of Arkansas. Studied music, studied piano with Maestro Joram Margulis. And currently I'm living in New York. A pianist, a musician, composer, arranger. A good friend of Nate from here. It's a pleasure meeting Jonah. Great musician and pianist. And I'm looking forward to do more music together.
As a trio, the first time you guys all played together was yesterday. Do I understand that correctly?
Yes.
So just talk about what that was like. And, you know, my background as a musician is classical. So improvisation kind of freaks me out. I'm not used to that. But talk a little bit about coming together as a trio and how you guys started working together and coming together as an ensemble.
I can talk about my experience, and it was a very good experience because, you know, I think as important as the music and the musicians, the vibe between the people.
Absolutely.
Is important.
Definitely.
And the communication and, you know, on a personal level. And, you know, we met up yesterday, we had a good talk, you know, about life. Yeah. And, you know, lots of laughs. So that's a great surface to start jamming out. And then, you know, we started playing, and that sense kept on being in the music of, you know, listening and, you know, try to be humble and create something together. And then, you know, the more you play together, you just get to know the people more and learn how to connect with them. It's like, you know, personal relationships.
Yeah, absolutely. And it came together easy, which is, like, so key to me that it's going well. You know, it came together just in a few tunes. And even the rehearsal was short because somebody hit Jonah's car outside my house.
It was cut short. It was hilarious. I was just getting in the groove, you know. At first, it's a little bit, whenever you meet someone new, it's a very exciting experience, but it's also a little bit of nerves, and which are good, you know. And so we play a couple tunes in, and I'm starting to really feel like connecting with these guys, and we hear a knock on the door, and this guy right across the street hit my car. So I had to cut it short a little bit, but still, it was...
I think the experience makes us tighter as a group than any rehearsal.
Yeah, I feel like it feels like it's been longer than a day. We've been through much in the matter of time.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But yeah.
And as far as like what you asked about improvisation, it's the cool thing about jazz is that it's a kind of a language that we all studied, and we all listen to a lot of the same people, you know, such as some of the people we already mentioned, like Miles and McCoy, and because we've studied that same language, we can come together from really different backgrounds and just do it and improvise in a way because you know, we've learned the same songs, we've learned kind of the same language, and we you know, can go about our business kind of in a similar way.
A lot of people, I think, don't realize that improvisation is a very particular skill that requires a huge knowledge base because some people, they think it's just, oh, you pick up an instrument and you just play around. And it's like, actually, people who are good at improvising have a wealth of knowledge, and you guys have to meld your minds together and kind of figure out how it all fits together so you guys come up with the sound that you want to create.
Yeah.
Totally.
Absolutely. I mean, it's so cool because... we're literally really from different backgrounds, both like musically and ethnically.
Right.
Like, I grew up in Hong Kong. I spent some time in Ecuador. I've been in the U.S. for a long time. Yaniv is Israeli, was born in Israel.
Yeah, born and raised.
Came here, lived in New York, which is a whole different scene, really serious jazz scene, something that I've only experienced kind of a little bit. I was in Berkeley. I went down to New York a lot. But it's really heavy. It's something I want to do someday. And Jonah has his own background. And the cool thing is that we can just get together and, like you said, meld those different perspectives into one thing and do what we're doing, which is like, it's kind of unique, you know, and it's just it's cool that we can throw together a band like this and be so comfortable so fast, and for it to sound unique, you know, right away, just because we're unique people and musicians.
Well, great. Thanks, guys. Thanks for playing music here in the performance studio and for talking to me about the music.
It's our pleasure.
Need to chill out. All right, ready? One, two. Oh, this song's called Suerte.
Thank you.
That was Suerte by Nate Wong, Jonah Wehas, and Yaniv Tabenhaus, who together are pianos and drums. The trio recently spoke with Of Note host Katie Henriksen inside the Furman Garner Performance Studio. The group will be performing at 7 o'clock tonight at 28 Springs in Siloam Springs. You can also catch the trio at 6:30 Sunday evening at Smoke in Tulsa. More information is available at natewongmusic.com.
This week on This American Life.
Okay, you had me pick up dandelions just to prove a point to me.
Okay, so you're still upset over the dandelion deal?
Yes, I really am.
An inmate and a prison guard tell each other how they really feel.
Was it hard?
No, I mean, it wasn't hard. It was just
Did it take a lot of time?
No, it didn't take a lot of time. It's still the principle. You made me pick up
dandelions. Did you break any bones?
No,
how your perspective changes when you're stuck inside a situation. This week,
flower that grows out the ground.
This American Life, tomorrow morning at 6 and Sunday morning at 10 on KUAF 91.3 FM. Support for Ozarks at Large comes in part from the University of Arkansas's Women's Giving Circle. The 15th annual KUAF Summer Jazz Series continues with Composer Showcase featuring the music of Rick Salonen tomorrow night in the Walton Arts Center's Star Theater. This performance will present the compositions and arrangements of Dr. Rick Salonen, performed by duos, trios, quartets, and quintets from local jazz artists, including the 18-piece Fayetteville Jazz Collective. Tickets and more information available online at KUAF.com or waltonartcenter.org.
A listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Dry Fork.
Dry Fork. Mm-hmm. That's Madison County?
Carroll County. Mm-hmm.
If you're on your way, it's on 412.
It is.
It's one of those places I think used to be like a real community and now is kind of...
You mean it was a lot larger?
Well, if not a lot larger, but somewhat larger. There used to be the Dry Fork store and things like that.
Huh.
Okay, Christina and I together Sunday morning at 9 for Weekend Ozarks at Large.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll be back on Monday.
Yep,
All right. Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Thanks so much for listening.